This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
And you're on Sunday Arts Magazine on Joy 94.9. And who's our next guest, Cara?
We have Shane McGrath, who is
I know this man from somewhere.
I think so.
Artist and a lecturer.
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
Sounds like you're lecturing about art, which sounds like fun.
Yes, it is.
And, well, I guess we're going to talk about your history as an artist today because you're not sort of plugging a future work or an exhibition.
No.
Not that I'm sure of.
No, not at all.
So tell us about your art career.
Well, let's just start off with that how I know Shane
is
he comes into the same cafe that I go to every day.
Correct.
And so one day we just got talking. I don't even know how it happened.
You're on a
semester break, weren't you?
I think I may have been. I was there every morning and so I would kind of take a little bit of work in and was like working away, and I think there may have been a conversation with the lovely staff at the cafe, and then you're just kind of, lecturing in arts. I do an arts program. You might have heard of it. And you would like to come in? I'm like, sure. It's only taken us a little bit of a while to.
And your fault because you've always had something else.
I know it was my fault.
But all good. And here you are. So let's get your story. Where did it all start from being an artist?
Depending how you asked. I know I think my mother's listening now. Well, my family's probably listening at home. We've just come from the Father's Day lunch.
Oh, happy Father's Day.
They're all like
Father's
tuning
Day
in. Yes, to Dan. But Mum would probably claim it started at a very young age. Biting toast into animal shapes and such, and then it kind of like blossomed from there. But even though the two of them don't come from like arts backgrounds, my mother is very clever, creative herself, a maker. She was always very hands-on and sewing and baking and just like decorating cakes and all sorts of things. So she's very, very clever. And we were lucky enough finally to exhibit together for the first time with one of the artifacts, the banner that I made for one of the projects I think we're going to talk about today, and that's exhibiting down at down in Moorabbin at the town hall down there in Kingston. So it kind of started from there, and always did arts through primary school, through secondary school. It was kind of just an assumed thing, I think.
Right. And did you study art when you left school?
I did. I had a bit of a lull. You know, everything was like in a year 12 and it was all short back and sides. And so after that, I left and I grew a beard and my hair. And I studied art at Box Hill TAFE when it still existed. Again, a lot of making and hands-on there. And then I worked for Scenic Studios, painting backdrops for ballet and for musical theatre and stuff. So Scenic Studios over in, it was at the time, I think, in North Melbourne way.
Right. Yep.
Then travelled overseas and got that out of my system, then came back and studied film over in Footscray. And at that young age, I think I was a little bit sceptical of like the contemporary art schools and what they were going to teach. And I think I was very, I look back now, I was very kind of closed-minded and very traditional in my approach, like what is art and constitute, And then it was only in my, totally. Oh, what a waste. But then in my late 20s, I'd moved to New Zealand and I just noticed I'd really missed making work, and I was studying art history at one of the universities there, but I ended up one day getting off the bus early because I noticed it went past a separate university, and I walked in and they had a arts program there, and I said, I'd like to come back and do art, please. And
okay.
That's where I actually did my undergraduate and master's in Wellington in New Zealand.
Right, okay. Wow.
Yeah, and it was I only meant to go there for maybe a year or two tops. That's what I told my family, and it just the art scene there was. It may have been small, but it was really like rich and really supportive, and it was such a really great group of people. And
that's New Zealand though, isn't it?
It is.
They're a very creative country for a small country.
Very much so. That and they love being. Everyone there loves being from New Zealand, and all the Kiwis I'd met in Melbourne prior to moving over there on a daily basis were copying it, but for the accent and the younger cousin, country cousin, all that sort of thing. So when I moved there, I expected to get the same sort of treatment, but no one cared. They were too busy being proud of being Kiwis, and I was like, oh, this is a great atmosphere. And I noticed that I, in Melbourne, had always thought about success or something overseas, elsewhere, whereas they were in New Zealand, they were proud of being Kiwis.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And the culture there was just... was so good, and all these opportunities kept coming up. So 1 year turned to two, turned to three, and at the end it was 7 years. And And anyway, so I had to go
it
back.
It sounds like it recontextualised that you could be an artist in Australia easily.
Well, easily. I actually had seen some artists who'd gone to Australia, and they were like big names in New Zealand. Like, they were representing New Zealand at the Venice Biennale and such, but then they go to Australia and they just weren't known. Because Australians were too busy looking at Australian artists and also looking, you know, bigger markets internationally overseas. Mm. And so I knew that I thought if things were going well in New Zealand, but if I didn't go back, I was going to maybe fall into the same trap. So after I unveiled my first like permanent public sculpture in Wellington City, which is like an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, tell us, what was it?
Well, it was. I was approached by one of the curators, Aaron, at the City Gallery, and there was Glover Park. It had been kind of this kind of non-space right in the middle of the city off Cuba Street. I don't know whether you know Wellington.
No, I don't.
It's like the Brunswick Street sort of Sydney Road sort of, yeah. And there was this park which had kind of gone unused, or the potential for it had not been realised. And there was this money left over from bequest, and they asked if I would make a work in conjunction with this sculpture exhibition, like a retrospective or this work about New Zealand sculpture. And I was bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I'm like, yeah, I'll do that. And how much is the budget? And they told me, I'm like, oh, that's a lot of money. And then you start making the public work. You're like, that's not much money. So, but we managed to do it with some assistance with a couple of silent donors and whatnot, and then unveiled this thing that looks like a cross between like a helter-skelter ride and like a Russian Orthodox church and a Vostok rocket ship in the middle of Glover Park. And it was the beginning of this revitalization. And next time I saw it, it was like a craft bar and people with beanbags and the grass underneath my sculpture and eating pizza.
Wow, awesome.
Yeah.
So what did you call it?
Everything is for the best and the best. Oh, God. I was going for that long title. That was like, hang on, everything's the best. So I keep thinking, hang on, that's not a Bob Dylan lyric. It's another one.
Come to you.
Yeah, I can look it up for you if you like. But
no, it's okay.
Yeah. Everything is for the best is what it was, the short.
Right.
It's like, and then it goes from the two sentences. Yep. But then I was on a plane 2 weeks after the unveiling of that, and I was back to Australia and having to start from scratch again. So.
And was that hard?
It was. I think because so much hard work had gone into all those years of, first of all, the years kind of like, not lost, but... started or finishing the degree and the master's quite late, but I was teaching over there. I was teaching life drawing and I was doing sculpture and painting and all that sort of stuff to the undergrads, and I felt like I'd put the time in. So when I came back, even though I knew I had to start from scratch, like in the back of my mind, the psychology was like, I deserve so much better than this. I've done all the hard work and no one knows me and cares and, like, you know, boo-hoo. So I think when I got back, the first thing I did was submit a sculpture into the Bondi Sculpture by the Sea.
Which is a fabulous competition.
It was. It's like a larger version of Headlands. There's one up on Waiheke Island, off the coast of, or in the bay of Auckland.
Yeah.
And that is a smaller, but very, it's just a fantastic public sculpture walk that they have out on the island. It's brilliant. And I was lucky enough to have a work out there, I think maybe a year or so before I came back. And again, you think, oh, I've made it, you know, and then you're waiting for the calls to come in or the invitations and things, and, you know, no, that doesn't happen, of course.
No, that's the arts for you.
Exactly, you learn that very quickly.
Yeah.
And so when I came back, I'll do it again, and then Bondi was like, I think the numbers of artists, like about 130, whereas I think I may have shown with maybe 30 or 40 artists. Mm. And I made an oversized Zeppelin made from like giant Meccano, which then I crushed so it looked like, Zeppelin, like the Hindenburg, looked like a mixture of the Hindenburg and a broken umbrella or something, but green and red and right there on the foreshore. And that was my first attempt to kind of break back in.
Yeah, and how did it feel being part of, because it's quite iconic around Australia now, like that walk, that art walk.
And over in Cottesloe as well, but it was great. I met some great artists while I was there, but then you quickly realise, you're really out of the loop and you've got to try and figure a way to get back in somehow, and it's been years now doing that. I think it's slowly, slowly, it makes some good progress.
And so how do you make a living?
Well, I lecture. Here's the thing. Like, I was teaching in Wellington with my masters, and it was fantastic. Like, these 12 weeks of life drawing and, you know, 12 weeks of sculpture. When I came back, I quickly realised that Melbourne universities had adopted the minimum of the
casualisation of the workforce.
Yeah, and you had to either have a doctorate or be in the process of getting the doctorate. And I always said, no, I've just finished my master's. And for 2 years, I tried every other avenue, and it just wasn't working. And a good friend of mine, who was one of my lecturers in Wellington, but I worked with him many, many times over, Professor David Cross, came back. He was also a Melbournean living in Wellington. That's how we bonded. He spotted me in one of his lectures, in one of my first second-year lectures. As it turns out, wearing his secondary school football jumper.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like it was like royal blue with like this like gold V and stuff. It looked like a Star Trekky shirt, which is why I bought it. But I knew it was a footy shirt, but it was obscure, and I thought I could get away with it New Zealand. And he spotted me in the audience. He thought it was And he came back, and he's like, you just got to saddle up and do the PhD, and he encouraged me actually go to Deakin where. He'd become I'd been offered a professor position there, and I've been doing my doctorate there for a number of years and lecturing in contemporary art practice in a number of different formats for, you know, first and second years.
What are you doing your PhD in?
That's a very good question.
I actually asked you that a few months back.
Yeah.
And you hadn't quite... Well, you didn't know how to explain it.
Well, it's gone through a couple... When I first pitched it, because I started the doctorate when I didn't... Like, I thought when I was just obsessed with the idea and it had to be a doctorate, then I would go and do my doctorate. But it was a case of, like, well, you just got to get onto it. So I then had to try and think, what the hell am I going to do? And my practice had gone from a very traditional, as I mentioned before, very traditional painting, drawing, portraiture. Like, I'd entered the Archibald, you know, unsuccessfully a couple of times. And it was all kind of, I guess, old school, for want of a better term. But my undergraduate studies in Wellington, I started doing, some three-dimensional drawing, which turned into installation, which turned into some performance, and I had my film background as well. And then I started making like kind of public works, doing performative, time-based works, and so I just ended up just like collecting all of these different skills and disciplines, which turned into what now would be a socially engaged practice or work with engaging with the public actually being part of the creation of the work. And the first big project I made like that, which turned out to be the first work for the doctorate, was the first instalment of Treatment, which was the public sculpture project out in Werribee, which was this strange combination between Melbourne Water and Deakin University and whatnot. So Melbourne Water and their the poo farm, basically, out in Werribee. And they said, we want to do a public sculptural event. And I was one of the artists that was selected for that. And David Cross and Dr. Cameron Bishop were curators for that.
Right.
And they said, we think you're perfect to make a project. They took us for a tour of the facilities, and they we came across what was the remains of this old township of Cockerock, which is the town that was built for all the workers and their families back in like the 1880s when the facilities were first built to basically, you know, so Melbourne had somewhere to send all the, you know, all their waste and sewage. And there was a big football field and a change rooms with like a pavilion there. I'm like, what the hell happened out here? And they're like, you know, told us about the history of the town. I said, who played out here? And it's like, well, they all did. And so, you know, I started asking about the history of the team, and they knew very, very little. And so I immediately was like, okay, I've got to make a work about the football team and the community that comes from there. And so that kind of started my first big major project about social practice, about placemaking, about history, and then all of the lovely details and recreation that kind of comes along with that. So,
yeah. So I've seen images of that because you made football. Did you recreate their uniforms, or did you make the uniforms?
I had them. I actually found one of the companies that makes football jerseys. This is an elderly gentleman, but his father made the VFL jumpers, and they still had all. They're one of the few places that still had all the old machines, the knitting machines that made every single section. They would knit separately, and then they'd sew it all together. And this was the beginning of what we now know as fibre of football. We can buy those replica jumpers.
That was the beginning of that.
Wow. That was right at the start.
Because I was thinking that when you were describing
it.
Wow.
I was very, very fortunate. They all the same old machines. It's all 100% Australian merino. all the colours have that very, very unique, like the whites are really cream and the red is like blood.
And imagine how heavy they would have been when they got wet.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they would have been so heavy.
Exactly. Yeah. But they timed it right because all of the people that played football back in the day would have had some, if it wasn't wool, it was the acrylic knit.
Yep.
But they would recognise those and they're the ones who are going to shell out, you know, $200-$300 for these jumpers. But they made replicas for me for that. And
fantastic.
I wanted to, because the last 64 was when the township closed down. And so I wanted to basically pick it up from where it left off. So we all were kind of, you know, more period costumes. I'm doing air quotes now. Period costumes. And I wanted it to be like a little moment in time. So when the audience arrived on the bus, which is how they got around, they would turn up and see all these players out in the middle of nowhere. Like, that would be like a mirage almost in the first place. And then they'll run off the field past the audience into the rooms and they'd kick everyone out, slam the doors, and then they would start with their coach's address inside there. But there was about place, it was about stigma of place. Like everyone, even people now, when they say they're from Werribee, people were making judgment. This is all my research. I realised people still being judged for being from this place. And the old players who I got to interview would tell stories about how they would get ridiculed for being from there as well, and you know, they call them the shit stirrers and all that sort of thing. But all the history I found out about the place was fascinating, and it was funny just listening to the interview prior with George from Affordable Art Fair, and that disconnect between kind of the high art and the low art, that's kind of right in between there is where my practice and my PhD is trying to sit. And that treatment project was actually quite a good one because we had, the audience was the art crowd from Melbourne, locals from Werribee, ex-players and their relatives, and everyone in between. And it was still, I think it was still successfully able to kind of pitch this work where everybody understood it, and it was, on the surface, it was, you know, like Aussie rules footy and no one really gets threatened by that, but that was just a filter to kind of push all these other ideas
That's amazing.
Thank you.
Let's just also talk about what you did down in Moorabbin.
Yes, so that was like a couple of years later, and the kind of the second work that sprung from the first. So whereas the first project in Werribee, I worked with the community in pre-production, and then I worked with my performers to kind of put the whole thing together. The this was a initiative put together by the Kingston City Council, City of Kingston, and Public Art Commission, which is a research initiative out of Deakin, and with support of Creative Victoria, and they wanted to make something similar lines. Again, six artworks. It's six different places around what is now the amalgamated City of Kingston, and moments or incidents or places throughout history. Just kind of highlight, you know, their rich history from down that way. And I was brought on board first as a researcher, trying to find, you know, little gold in all the Moorabbin Standard to hand out to the artists for inspiration. But one of the works that, again, David Cross and Cameron Bishop, curators, they had an idea in mind, which was Rick Springfield. His family house was down in Parkdale.
As in Rick Springfield, the singer?
Rick Springfield, the singer, who everyone thinks is American, who famously...
I had no idea he was Australian until your website today.
Pink Zoot. Pink Zoot you wouldn't probably know.
Daryl Cotton
was the singer of Pink Zoot.
Yeah.
They all wore pink outfits and yellow. And then, yes, he went over to America and became... and was
no idea.
A TV actor as well.
He had an animated series.
Yeah.
He's been on stage doing like EFX, I think he's in Vegas. He's like... he's been in everything. He's what do you call it? Not his discography, his filmography, and all his TV. He's just done so many things. I had no idea. And David actually sent me the biography, his autobiography, which is quite a fascinating read. The last house that he lived in before he went to the States was in Parkdale, and his parents lived there until both of their passings. And we only really found out about it when he and his brother came back to put the house on the market, and even the real estate companies like put like a picture of Rick Springfield on the ad to try and plug it. The irony being that the couple that bought it, a young family, had no idea who Rick Springfield was, and so when we approached them saying we'd like to make an artwork on your street about Rick Springfield's house, they had to look him up and to find out who the hell the guy was. So that was hilarious. But the driving or the idea that underpinned all of these projects, at least in its early stages, was they wanted to make a community engaged public art project. And not only to have them in the pre-production, like I had in Werribee, but in the making of the work. And so I thought, well, you know, because there's certain kind of logic, it makes sense. Well, why don't I just engage as many different community music acts to perform Jesse's Girl in his street, and we just like put on a street parade. That was like my initial idea. Like, yeah, why not?
This is awesome stuff. This is awesome. And everyone went for it.
They went for it. Like, at the trying to find the groups and the bands. Like, they said, what kind? I don't care. They can be playing spoons and I don't know, doing like mouth and noise. I don't care. As long as they're from the community and they're engaged and they like the idea and they don't take themselves too seriously. Which is like, I take my work seriously, but I don't take myself too seriously. And so I like to try and, you know, pitch it in between there. And they're on board. So we had, it was fantastic. Like, literally a block and a half away was the Parkdale Secondary College. And Ryan James, one of my performers, who's been actually in a number of my works before, great artist, friend of mine. His old kindergarten mate, I think kindergarten primary school mate, was the music teacher up at Parkdale Secondary College around the corner. And then we had Amanda Cooper, who was part of the Long Beach ukulele band down that way. Turns out her mum, Julie Cooper, a work was being made about her in the same, you know, umbrella project, because she was the first female mayoress of Moorabbin, and that work was being made about her. Then I had the Filipino Seniors Association say, yeah, we want to come along. You know, every weekend they get together and they love karaoke and partying. Yeah, let's go. And the finishing it out was the Voices pop choir, Moorabbin and Mordialloc. So I had no idea what to expect. And the only brief was you need to be able to walk down the street playing the song. And so the audience would arrive on the bus once again. And they'd be met by myself and probably one of the members of my family. We're all wearing our white shirts with our black ties and our picture of Rick Springfield on our breast, because that's how Ronnie, the Bull Terrier, Rick's Bull Terrier, was shown on the cover of the album.
That's right.
Working Class Dog.
Yeah.
And we'd also have a couple of dogs from the Bull Terrier Club of Victoria. And then we'd be marching down the street performing Jesse's Girl, and right at the front would be our Rick Springfield on the back of a flatbed out front of the house playing the guitar solo for the culmination of the song. And it was... everyone absolutely loved it. It was so much fun.
And does he know that this happened?
He does know. I wanted to let him know it was happening and you know, didn't want to get involved somehow. But I think because his mother had passed away only a couple of years earlier, and he had a very close relationship with his mother, and I think bringing that up, he didn't want... He said, we're happy for it to go ahead.
Yep.
Don't want to get involved directly.
Yeah.
Someone in the street, one of his old friends, sent him a photograph, which he posted on Instagram saying,
no.
He's like, oh, look at this. This is weird. They're doing some historic tour at my old house. I wonder what my old mum would think if she came out and found a band playing a song in a driveway. So it was good. I've got to send him a package of...
Of the whole thing.
Yeah.
You should. It's an amazing story.
Thank you.
story. Can't wait to see what you do next on that level.
Thank you so much.
That's brilliant. So thank you for coming in today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
See you in the cafe.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.